talk this morning about how, is that too resonant? We talked this morning about how, yeah, there's too much echo in there. Is that better? Is that better? Can you hear me in the back? Okay. A little higher. That question, of course, is a trick question. If you can't hear me in the back, then how are you going to know? Okay. We talked this morning about how discernment is basically pragmatic and strategic. And this is pointed out in passage number 2 in the readings. This is actually part of a larger sutta where the Buddha says there are 4 courses of action. There is a course of action that is pleasant to do and will give good results. The course of action that is unpleasant to do and will give bad results. And those two are no-brainers. It's pleasant, it gives good results, you'll do it. If it's unpleasant, gives bad results, you're not going to do it. The difficult ones are the ones that are mentioned in this passage, the one that's pleasant to do but will give bad results, and the one that's unpleasant to do but is going to give good results. And that's where you need your discernment to talk yourself into doing what is going to give good results regardless of whether you like it, and what's going to give, talk yourself out of doing things that will give bad results regardless of whether you like it. And so this connects with passage number 3, which talks about the 4 ways that we go off course. We go off course out of desire, we go off course out of aversion, off course out of delusion, and off course out of fear. These are the explanations for why people act in a biased or prejudiced way. One of those 4 things will lead them to act in unskillful ways. Which means that those are 4 qualities that we have to learn how to overcome, because those are the things that are going to get us to do things that are not in our long-term interests and to not do things that are in our, that are in our long-term interests. And so we have to look at those 4. Of the 4, you have to realize that aversion is always bad, delusion is always bad. It's the fear and the desire you have to be more discerning about. There are some desires that are actually good, and there are some fears that are actually good. Now, there's a fear of doing something unskillful. That's actually a good fear. The fear of causing harm to yourself, causing harm to others, that is something to be afraid of. This would be the fear of heedfulness and the fear of compunction. There is a fear underlying these things, that you don't want to do anything that's going to cause harm, because it just multiplies the harm more than what you're already dealing with. You can't overcome this fear. You can't really trust. Your primary fear, of course, is the fear of death. And if you can't overcome this fear, you can't really trust yourself to act in your own best interests. There'll always be something to say, well, I'm afraid I'm going to die, so there I don't want to. I could, you know, break the precepts out of fear of death. I could do other unskillful things out of fear of death. And you have to learn how to overcome this. This is one of the areas where I think learned the most from my first time with the John Fuang. There was one night he said, are you afraid of dying? In any place in the world, everybody would say, yes, of course. But I realized, okay, if I said yes, it was not part of the custom or the culture of that particular tradition. So how do you overcome fear of death? This is what the next passage is about. Basically, there are 4 things that cause us to be afraid of death. Attachment to sensual pleasures, attachment to the body, fear of the consequences of the past things we've done that have been unskillful, and then not seeing the true Dharma. In other words, you're afraid you're going to die, that once you die, you're going to be deprived of the sensual pleasures you enjoy in the human realm. You're going to be taken away from the body to which you're attached. There is the fear that, okay, after you die, maybe there really is such a thing as punishment after death, and gosh, all those horrible things I did, they're going to come and get me. And then there's ultimately the fear of not seeing the true Dharma. The true Dharma is basically realizing there is a deathless property that you can contact through the practice. And if you haven't seen that, there's always fear death might be annihilation. There's, you know, the body dies and that's it. And so it's learning how to overcome these four fears that make us more reliable. So that when something comes up, and even though there could be the prospect of, you know, we could die by following the practice, okay, I would rather stick with the practice and die rather than abandon the practice and try to survive that way. This is illustrated in that analogy that I told you earlier about the bandits pinning you down and sawing off your limbs, and the Buddha says you still have to have goodwill for them, even in a situation like that. Because if you have ill will for them, that ill will is going to then carry on into the next lifetime and get you fixated on those people, fixated on revenge. And that could lead you to do all kinds of unskillful things. So the way to overcome these four things, these four kinds of fear, is a process where the Buddha says basically has five steps. Is learn how to develop dispassion for these things. And the five steps start out with one is, when you see something unskillful arising in the mind, you want to see it as it arises. In other words, what is originating? It's not just a simple arising. When it arises, there's a cause that goes along with it. And you can apply this particular analysis, if you want to any kind of addiction you have. Number one, of course, is internet addiction. It's endemic up here. You walk into walking into an airport lounge, what do I see? Everybody on their screens, you know. I have a friend who has a friend who's psychic, who's been for many years getting messages from, you know, people who died and basically having to help them move on to the next level. And has discovered in the past several years that the hardest thing for people to let go of after they've died is their devices. Can you imagine? So watch out. So suppose you have an internet addiction, okay? You have to see the moment that says to you, I've got to check my email, even though you checked your email 5 minutes ago. Okay, what is it that is the compulsion to go back, you know, to get in there? So see that arising. Don't wait until it's become a full-blown desire. But what is the first spark in the mind? I'd like to do this again. See what's going along with it. What sort of physical symptoms do you have? What kind of mental systems do you have at that point that would induce you to say, I've got to go with this thing, even though part of me knows that I'm way too addicted to the internet. Then you want to see it passing away. Because these impulses are not as constant as they pretend to be. In other words, part of your mind will say, if I don't give in to this now, it's just going to get stronger and stronger and stronger until it turns into the thing and takes over. So I got to appease it now while it's still manageable. It's not really that way. The impulse will come, the impulse will go. And it's not like it builds up to kind of a crescendo. It comes and goes, comes and goes. The part of the mind that wants you to go, that will make it seem more like a crescendo, but you have to see it does come and it goes, it stops. Even desires or anger that seem to be unending do have their point. Anger is one of the most difficult ones to see, because once there's been a moment of anger arises in the mind, there are hormones that get into your system. And then even though the moment of anger will have passed, the hormones are still there, and you interpret that, oh, it's a sign I'm still angry. Pick it up again. You got to remind yourself, okay, the hormones are one thing, the physical symptoms are one thing, the actual anger is something else. Don't confuse the two. So it's good to know that. Because you look for the arising of the thought, you look for the passing away of the impulse. And then the third thing you look for is the allure. The allure. Why do you go for it? What is attractive about this? What do you think you're getting out of this? What are the excuses, or what are the reasoning in the mind that says you got to go for, and that something about you wants to go for this? Now, in some cases where you know that the impulse is unskillful, part of the mind will try to hide it from you. You don't like to admit to yourself that it really does, you know, those thoughts of revenge. There was a great New Yorker cartoon where two witches are over a big boiling cauldron, and one of them is tasting the brew, and she says, it's too sweet, you put in too much revenge. Okay, what is it about revenge that's sweet? You know? What is about something you know is unskillful that you like about it, basically? We've got to look for that. And then you can compare it with the drawbacks. I mean, you may see the drawbacks, but if you don't see the appeal, you're not doing a fair comparison. And for seeing the drawbacks, this is where the Buddhist teachings on, say, the three characteristics come in. Is this something that's lasting? The reward that comes from this, is it lasting? If it's not lasting, it's going to be stressful. And if it's not lasting and stressful, is it worth identifying with? Now notice the Buddha's not saying it's stressful, it's constant stressful. He's not saying there is no self. The whole thing about the perception of not self is that it's a value judgment. Is this really worth sticking with? And it's when you can compare the allure and can compare the drawbacks, and you begin to do this kind of analysis that, you know, whatever appeal, whatever reward you get out of this is not lasting, but the drawbacks are going to be much more, much heavier. That's when you find the escape from it, i.e. you develop dispassion for it. Now the question sometimes comes up was, how do you know that this something is going to be for your long-term interest as opposed to just a short-term interest? And the Buddha doesn't have you invent the Dharma wheel every time you have to make this decision. You know, this is why we have the five precepts. If there's an impulse to break the five precepts, you know there's something wrong. And that whatever would pull you away, you know, your fear of losing money, your fear of losing your friends, your fear of harming your health by sticking to a precept, you have to say, I can't go with that. My concern about my health, my concern about my friends, my concern about the wealth, that has to be seen as something to develop dispassion for. Similarly, when your mind is in concentration, everything that at that moment that would pull you out of the concentration, you've got to say, that is unskillful. I've got to learn how to apply these three perceptions. The Buddha never calls them three characteristics, by the way. The three perceptions that you apply as an analysis for developing dispassion. So in other words, while you're on the path, you don't apply these three perceptions to the path. You apply them to everything that would pull you off. And then as your discernment gets more and more refined, and you get further and further along the path, you get to the point where, okay, it's the raft that you have to let go of, and then you start applying those perceptions to the path itself. But up until that point, you regard your karma as your own. You regard your treasure. You regard your virtue as your treasure. You regard your concentration as your treasure. Hold on to those things. And you apply these perceptions to anything that would pull you away. If it's a case of an obvious addiction, it's okay. You apply them to the source of the addiction, and then whatever you can find that will leverage you away from the addiction, you're going to hold on to that for the time being. This is one of the reasons why this is good to develop a state of concentration that you can access when you need it. It gives you an alternative source of pleasure. Because a lot of the times the mind will say, I'm really hungry for something right now, I'm desperate for pleasure. Or I worked hard all day, I need to give myself a little present. Well, a little present of something that's going to be unskillful in the long term, that's not a present. You say, well, if I can just breathe in a way that feels refreshing, breathe in a way that feels good, that takes a lot of the edge off that hunger for immediate gratification. So use that as your leverage. And then as you examine the detachment. Question in the back? Traveling mic?
Thank you. I have a question about how you go from the first one to the second. So the first one was to look at the impulse. Mm-hmm. Then the second you say is to see the impulse go away. Mm-hmm. I guess when I'm under the compulsion of, using the internet, for example. It feels like I have to take your word for it, that mm-hmm. if I do nothing, it's going to go away. Mm-hmm. Because that's not what my mind is thinking at that time.
That's not what it's thinking at that time. Your mind has already kidnapped you.
Yeah. So is, like, I'm almost like in disbelief. Like, I'm asking you, is it true?
Okay, the thing is, you have to keep feeding that impulse for it to continue.
So is it thinking about something else or just breathing or?
Well, you can ask yourself, okay, is there, where am I feeling tension in the body right now that's making me feel on edge that I've got to give into this? Can I breathe through that? And just the fact that you've asked that question has moved you out of the impulse, at least momentarily.
Oh, so you're using this tactic that will naturally lead you to seeing it.
It can lead you.
That can lead you if you use it.
Well, there's a famous story in Thailand about this one woman who went to see Chokun Ubali, who was a monk who was reputed to have a very sharp tongue. And so you went in to see him at your own risk. And she had just lost her only child, her son, who was 20-some years old. And she was just desperate. You know, she'd said, you know, ever since he's died, I can't think of anything but how much I miss him and how sad I am about this. And he said, oh, you're just saying that to impress other people. She was livid. And she didn't even bow down. She just left. She went home. And after 3 hours, she realized she hadn't thought about her son for 3 hours. She was so angry at Ajahn Kunupali. So she went back and bowed down. So that's replacing one defilement with another one. But but it does help you see that the things you think that are there in the mind, they're eating away and seem to be relentless, they're not as relentless as you think. Part of your mind is actually feeding them. And when you can see that, that's when you realize, okay, if I don't feed this, they're going to go. And what feeds them, of course, is the thought, okay, this is just going to get worse and worse and worse until I finally give in, so I might as well give in now. Or the other thought that says, well, you're going to give in anyhow, so let's make it easy for both of us, and, you know. Those kinds of things, you know. Because those are the thoughts that continue the impulse. So this is basically, okay. Apology.
I have a question on that. Watching the impulse come and it go away, and then the allure part, that seems to be a little tricky because it seems like sometimes the mind has got all sorts of stories to tell you, like, oh, it's a... You need to look at it. It's your work or something of that sort. And, I mean, in cases where it is not my work or something, then it's easy to tell myself that, no, there is, those other addictions, I can just tell myself, no, there is no need to go there at all. But when it comes to addiction to, you know, checking emails and things like that, it's, it seems almost like the only way I'm able to discipline myself is like saying, okay, I'm going to have a set amount of time in the day that I will use for internet, and I'm not going to do anything beyond that. Right. It can work on maybe weekends or something, or holidays, but it doesn't seem to work at all on weekdays. Comments, suggestions?
Okay, well, again, you've got to maybe on the weekdays you say, oh, if the weekends you look at the email twice a day. At work, you look at it 4 times a day, max.
4 times a day.
I wish my work were that simple.
Okay, this is obviously this is a monk talking to you. I don't have any competition for my job.
Thank you.
But at least, you know, you've got to figure out what is the reasonable amount and when does it get unreasonable. And then if you catch yourself, well, I look at my email and then I look at Yahoo News and then I look at this and I look at that and it gets further and further away from your work. The next time you feel the impulse, you say, okay, remember what happened last time? I looked at the news and then all of a sudden, you know, I was off, you know, doing something else.
But it's never usually fortunately maybe, but I'm not particularly attracted to the news. But it seems like I'm more attracted to an email message that comes from a colleague or something, and I might have sent him something, and I'm expecting a response or something. There's that impulse to go and keep checking.
It's like pushing the L button. You know?
Yeah, give me the response. The button is not going to give me the response, but right. It seems like there's that impulse. I don't know. Don't know what to say.
Well, again, if you found that, you know, the last time I checked email, it was 5 times before I actually got the message. Fifty, okay. And, okay, I got to cut down. And no message in the computer world is that time sensitive. Okay.
Yeah. Got to convince yourself.
You got to convince yourself of that. And it reminds you, just because something is pressing doesn't mean it's important. That's the other thing you've got to remind yourself. So this is something where you've got to work out, okay, at what point does it get excessive? At what point is it counterproductive? Because that's what an addiction is, it's counterproductive. And the time you could have spent doing actual work instead of checking your email gets wasted. So provide yourself with other arguments on the other side. And aside from the fact that you've got to get that answer from that colleague right away. That's all I can offer.
Thank you.
But again, it's this five-step pattern. You can find yourself, I'm addicted to something that's against, you know, it really is interfering with what something is in my best interest. And then how does it arise? How does it pass away? What is the allure? What keeps pulling me there? And then fourth one is saying, what are the drawbacks of what I'm doing? Compare the two until you can get a sense of dispassion for it. And then the dispassion is the escape. Now, dispassion does not mean aversion. It means kind of growing up. Where John Cha's explanation is, it's like sobering up. You know, you're intoxicated with how fast these things are and how quick these things are, but it's an intoxication. And a more mature part of your mind will say, look, I don't have to check 50 times before I get the message. So obviously, that's all the work I could be doing otherwise is getting wasted. And then you remind yourself the next time you feel the impulse to push the button or click the mouse.
May I ask you a follow-up on this? Mm-hmm. This is related to addiction to sensuality. Mm-hmm. So I've been reading passages from your book on the comparison to sensuality that the Buddha gives, like the comparison of a leper, mm-hmm. and the comparisons to a dry grass, fire Touch. Stick, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like they're very good ways for me to kind of, images for me to hold when there is a kind of a thought of sensuality that arises, so kind of zap it, or I can see that how the impulse goes away is related to how I'm kind of fabricating these kind of images in my mind about sensuality, so it goes away. Mm-hmm. But I'm not able to kind of see it as a dispassion. I see it more like, in my mind, I tell myself, okay, this is something I just do not want to do. It's not good for me. It's more like an aversion sort of thing I'm kind of building up, how do you see it?
In the beginning, it will be aversion.
And it's good aversion.
It's a good aversion. And then with time, it'll get more and more temperate, so that you're just going to lose interest. I mean, like when I realized I had to get, stop eating sweet things. Mm. At first it was, and so I developed a strong aversion to the sweet things, thinking, this is going to kill me if I keep on eating all these sweets. And so I had to see the sugar industry as my enemy. And then after a while it got so that, being away from sugar, the smell of sugar became repulsive. And I just, then I lost interest. And that's how it happens. I mean, there will be an aversion to begin with because you really got to fight things in the beginning. Mm. And then as you get more and more successful and you develop a better repertoire, you don't need to keep on using the club. But don't be afraid to use the club in the beginning.
All right.
They talk about being gentle, sitting, having your anger sit down with you, have a cup of tea. You can't do that in the beginning. It's going to poison your tea.
Right.
So you got to say, okay, no compromises with the anger. And then after a while, then you can back off after you've gotten away from it more.
Okay.
Are you saying that you've got to make discussion,
you have to have
yes, I'll repeat your question because you didn't have the mic. Do you have to have positive aversion in the beginning to develop dispassion? In the beginning, yes. Again, it has to be aversion toward the drawbacks. This is going to really do me harm. I don't want that. And you have to make it strong enough so that all those other voices that come up in the mind that say, oh, yes, you really do, it's okay, it doesn't matter. You have to, no. And then after a while you begin to realize, okay, that's excessive, I don't need all that. But it's... You have to artificially create the positive aversion. Again, it really helps with the sugar industry. I mean, or the sugar, or reading about the sugar industry helps with that. You know, there's somebody out there who's actually trying to hook me. And so I said, I'll show them. It was like being a Western monk in Thailand. You know, on the one hand, you hear about all these stories about how the Thais really are amazed with Western monks and everything. Well, it's kind of like the amazement you see with a dancing elephant. I mean, the fact that they can dance is amazing in and of itself. You don't expect them to dance well, you know. And so people would come to see John Fu and say, oh, you see these Westerners ordained. Do you think they really understand the Dharma? You know? And so my reaction was, I'll show them. So that's using an unskillful mental state to counteract a more unskillful mental state. You know? Okay. So it's okay. Question over here? Yeah, can we have the mic?
I haven't really thought of this, but this just came up for me, is how do you do that for, like, judging a judger? How do you use...
Is the judging in your mind or judging another person?
Who's judging someone who is judging. Okay. Yeah, you judge them.
Okay, you have to have some compassion for them. I mean, passing judgment on other people is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just learning how to use the right criteria. You know, if I imitated this person, would this be a good person to follow? You say no. Now, do I have to hang around this person? Maybe yes. In which case, how do I train myself so that I don't get pulled into their way of thinking, one. And two, how I don't start getting judgmental about the person. You've got to have compassion.
Would it be the same for, like, judging your own judging thoughts?
Okay, well, ask your judging thoughts, what kind of criteria are you using? And are you actually giving the person that you're judging, are you giving them a fair chance? Because, again, passing judgment on someone else as a potential person to hang out with, a potential person to associate with, a potential person to emulate, that's a valid use of your faculties of judgment. But as to passing a final, you know, judgment on whether this person is, you know, a really, really good person or a really, really bad person, you say, I don't really know that much. But it's okay to say, do I want to imitate this person? No. Yes. Whatever you come up with. Don't be afraid of passing judgment. There's a difference between being judgmental and being judicious. You can't stop, you know, you have to use your judicious powers. But the judgmental powers, those are the ones you have to recognize. Okay, I'm not giving this a fair chance. I'm not really looking at all the evidence before I pass my judgment. I've got to withhold judgment for the time being.
Thank you.
Okay. Question here? Here comes the mic.
Thank you. So it's about the second passage. It's about the fool.
Mm-hmm.
So the fool doesn't do something which is unpleasant to do, but which leads to what is profitable done. So he doesn't do it. And then my question is, the non-doing of that course of action leads to what is unprofitable.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How can inactivity lead to something?
Okay, but the fact that there was something you could have done that would have been profitable, but you don't do it, the results are going to be unprofitable.
Is that given the fact that he's a fool?
No, it's given the fact that he's not doing it.
But for an arahant, he can be totally static.
Yeah, because he doesn't have any work he has to do, or she doesn't have to do any work to do that they have to do anymore in terms of perfecting their mind.
Maybe you can help me understand. So the fool doesn't do what is profitable, and then is it because there's an opportunity cost that he's not...
There's an opportunity cost, yeah, that he's missing. Or she's missing.
Okay. All right.
This is particularly for the issue of, you know, being on the path and learning. It's okay if, you know, if I actually develop powers of concentration, it would be good for me. But I'm not going to do it. Because, gee, I'm sitting all those hours and it's going to be painful, and so I just won't do it. And there's a lot you're missing out on as a result. Okay, I've got 3 or 4 pages on discernment, which we've just got to skip. Because we're never going to get there. Okay. Any last questions on the use of discernment in everyday life? Remember, the discernment the Buddha's talking about here is pragmatic, it is strategic. Sometimes with strategy, that means, as we mentioned earlier, you've got to learn how to use one unskillful mind state to undercut a more serious unskillful mind state. It's like being a cook. Remember, the Buddha uses the image of feeding as in parallel to clinging. And we're actually fixing our food. This is when we say something is fabricated or something is conditioned. It's basically like fixing your food that then you're going to eat. And to develop dispassion means basically not only seeing, I don't want to eat this anymore, but because I don't want to eat it anymore, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to cook this meal anymore. And that's how dispassion leads to cessation. In other words, remember the image that all experiences, all phenomena come from desire. There's an intentional element in there or else it wouldn't happen. And what motivates the intention is, you know, the anticipation that you're going to get something good out of this. I mean, the best image I can think of is you've got some chickens and you keep feeding the chickens because you want to eat the eggs. But our problem is that we're pretty undiscerning about what comes out of chickens. And we eat everything that comes out of the chickens. You know, scrambled chicken droppings. You know. And so we've got to learn, one, we have to learn to be more discerning about this process of fabrication that we do in our minds. What can we do that's going to create a path rather than just, you know, willy-nilly fixing everything that comes out of our chickens. And so on the one hand, we learn to distinguish, okay, what are the chicken droppings, what are the eggs? We feed the chickens for the eggs, but then we learn how to develop the mind, so ultimately we don't even have to eat the eggs, which means that we can let the chickens go, and they're free to feed themselves. So this is the basic image that the Buddha is operating on. So we're, in the meantime, we're learning how to think strategically, because sometimes, as we pointed out now, you have to use an unskillful mental state to overcome another unskillful one. And a classic example in John Lee's autobiography is he's talking about when he was a young monk, and he and some of the other monks would have meditation contests. You know, who can sit longer? Who can do walking meditation longer? And of course, it's silly, but it trains you to be a longer meditator, you know. And when you finally realize it's silly, by that time you've developed some good habits otherwise. So sometimes you start out with something that's not quite 100% skillful, but it's leading you in the right direction. When I was a young monk, there was another Thai guy who ordained pretty much the same time I did. And we'd go up to the top of the hill and meditate. And I'd be sitting there, you know, in pain from the meditation and being, you know, chewed up by the mosquitoes or stabbed by the mosquitoes. And I was ready to give up. And I'd look over at him and he's very quiet. I said, for the good name of America, I can't. I can't let this. So I keep on sitting. I found out later that he was sitting there in pain, being, you know, in pain of the mosquitoes. He'd opened his eyes and there was a stupid American over there and said, very good business. And so we kept each other going, you know. So there are times when you use something unskillful to develop something to overcome something that's even more unskillful. But it's all part of learning how to think strategically. And this is what the actual practice teaches your discernment. And you might come to say, well, you shouldn't have any clinging, therefore I'm not going to cling to my concentration. That's wrong. I mean, I was actually reading in a book someone saying that, you know, if you stay focused on one object, that's obviously clinging, so you just have to let go. Which, you know, short circuits the whole path. Any last questions on discernment before going? Don't you?
Passage number 4 is talking about perplexion over not having touched the true Dhamma.
Yes.
So this is sort of one of the fears I have. So what is the way to get over
the what?
What's the way to get over this fear?
Stream entry.
Something more.
You thought the perfections were just, you know, sort of talking down to lay people? No, this, you've got to work on getting the stream.
Okay. All right.
Why do you look shocked?
No, well, it's a lofty goal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because that's the only way you're going to totally overcome your fear of death. Otherwise, there's always that possibility that maybe the secular Buddhists are right, there is nothing after you die. And you have to have it, you have to be able to see for yourself, oh, that's not true. There is a deathless element that you can contact. There's something that doesn't die. And then you realize, okay, it would be better to die than to, you know, break my precepts. It would be better to die than to go away from the path. And that confirms this for you. Up until that point, there are always going to be doubts.
So you use fear of death to motivate yourself, but we have to ultimately overcome this fear of death.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. And the fear that you're using to motivate yourself then turns into heedfulness,
yeah,
and compunction. You know, I don't want to do anything that would be, you know, more dangerous than death. And you've got to see it that way. And when you have that set of values, then, you know, that's when these become perfections.
Thank you.
Well, that relates to the next section, which is on goodwill. Okay, and first I want to give you a few general notice we're not covering all the readings. You can read them on your own. But I want to give you the main points before we leave. Okay. The word here is metta, which I translate as goodwill rather than loving kindness. Because love is a different word in Pali. It's bhema, as in bhema children. And bhema, or love, is not something that you can make universal. And the Buddha points out how there is hatred that comes from love, there's love that comes from hatred. It's an interesting analysis, you know. You love X, so and so someone else treats X well, you're going to love the other person. You love X, so and so mistreats X, you're going to hate that person. You hate X, someone else treats X well, you're going to hate that person. So you hate X, someone else is bad to X, you're going to love that person. It's all very arbitrary. It's not a universal, you know, something that you can universalize. Whereas goodwill, as I said earlier this morning, is the desire for beings to be happy, and realizing that, as we'll discuss goodwill under the heading of discernment, what does discernment teach goodwill? One of the lessons you learn is that people are going to be happy through their own actions. So you're basically wishing, may this person be skillful. And you can think of this of anybody. People who are already skillful, you can wish this. Then may they continue being skillful. People who are unskillful, then may they change their ways. This is what goodwill means. One of the lessons I got in goodwill was John Fuhren was talking one time about how he had a snake move into his room. Sort of an unexpected roommate. And he knew the snake was in there. The snake would hide behind, he had this one piece of furniture in the room, the snake would hide the piece of furniture as the John Fuhren would come in the room. And to begin with, he used it as a test for, okay, can I have goodwill for the snake? And so for 3 or 4 days, he just, you know, thoughts of goodwill, thoughts of goodwill, thoughts of goodwill. And, you know, he'd come into the room, the snake would hide. Okay, goodwill to the snake. And then finally, at the end of the third day, he said, okay, I've learned to overcome my fear of the snake. I think this is enough. And so he sat and meditated and said in his mind to the snake, he says, not that I don't like you. It's simply that we're different levels of species, and it's very easy to misunderstand one another. I love that. And there's plenty of room out there in the forest for you to be a happy snake. why don't you go out in the forest? And he left the door open, and the snake left. And so I thought that was really interesting. And he said it was from his goodwill for the snake that that's how he wished it. In other words, he's not saying, I'm going to sit there and love you and pet you. Sometimes goodwill means we have to be apart. So it's not really so much loving kindness, it's you wish well for the other side. And as I said this morning, there's that that image in fact, the sutta that we're going to be looking at in a minute, where they talk about the mother willing to sacrifice her life for her child. The Buddha's not saying you have to be willing to sacrifice your life, love your life for everybody, or cherish people that much. You are willing to sacrifice your life to maintain your goodwill, as in the case of the bandits sawing your limbs off. You still have to have goodwill, even though it means you're going to die. But you want to maintain that goodwill. Now, this brings goodwill under the purview of what does discernment tell us about goodwill? It tells you what it means to wish others well, i.e., may they act on the causes for true happiness. May they understand them, be willing and able to act on those causes. It also teaches you what it means to create a mind state in yourself. As the Buddha gives us analysis of what he calls the three kinds of fabrication. There's bodily fabrication, which is the breath. Verbal fabrication, which is directed thought and evaluation, i.e. the way you talk to yourself about an issue. And then there's mental fabrication, which is the perceptions you hold in mind and the feeling tones that you're creating inside you. And you realize if you have ill will for somebody, you have to take that apart in terms of these three fabrications. Change the way you breathe. To ask yourself, how am I talking about this issue that is aggravating the ill will? Can I talk about it in a way that promotes goodwill? And then that relates to the perceptions you're holding in mind, which would be mental fabrication. All too often when we're passing judgment on someone, we're way up here in the judge's seat and they're way down there. We feel that my passing judgment on that person has no impact on me. I'm free to judge them in whatever terms I want. But the Buddha's reminding you, if you go around, you know, having ill will for other beings and seeing nothing but their weaknesses and their bad points, it's going to be very hard for you to actually treat others well. So you actually need to look for the good in other people as a motivation, as a way of nourishing your own goodwill. The image he gives is, you know, it's someone who's walking through the desert and they see, and they're hot, trembling, with thirst, tired. They see a cow's footprint with a little bit of water in the cow's footprint. They realize if they tried to scoop up the water, it would make it muddy, so what do they have to do? They have to get out and slurp it up. Now, you wouldn't want anybody taking a picture of you while you're doing that. You know? And you feel that it might be beneath your dignity, but you've got to do it because it's for your own survival. In the same way, when someone's been mistreating you and say, I can't feel goodwill for this person, or I can't see the good of this person, that's beneath my dignity. But then you realize, okay, I need that person's goodness in order to make sure that I'm more skillful around that person. At least keep that goodness in mind. And so you're willing to, in what you might be telling yourself, lower yourself to look for the person's good points so that you're not going to mistreat the person. So it's another image the Buddha has you hold in mind. That would be a perception, that would be a mental fabrication that you would use to take apart the mind's conversation that's telling you, well, this person did this, this person did that, and it's really outrageous, and how can I stand this, and wait a minute. Human beings are like this. John Fung had a student one time who was, she was a nurse, and she was the victim of some gossip among the other nurses. And she was really getting sick and tired of the gossip, and she went to meditate with him one time, and she had this vision of her many lifetimes as being like a hall of mirrors, going back, 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 and she's probably realizing, I've probably been the victim of gossip many times in the past. It just became overwhelming and oppressive. And so after she came out of meditation, she mentioned to him, he's like, it's just overwhelming me, just how much gossip I've been subject to. And he said, well, who asked you to be born in the human realm? This is the human realm. You were the one who wanted to be born as a human being. This is what human beings do. Shocked her. But then she sent me one of those messages that she remembered for the rest of her life. And you're here on this realm. What do you expect out of this realm? You can't let yourself get upset by the fact that human beings are behaving like human beings. You gotta say, I gotta rise my, you know, raise my mind above that. Now notice that when the Buddha talks about goodwill, he doesn't say it's part of your innate nature to have goodwill for others. He says it has to be, the potential is there, but we can also be just as, we have the potential also to have ill will or to have very limited goodwill. So he says it has to be a determination. You have to make up your mind that, yes, this is something I want to do. I need to develop this. And it's also a form of mindfulness. You have to keep reminding yourself, I've got to have goodwill for this person. You turn on the news, you see somebody doing something on the news you don't like, got to have goodwill for this person. And that kind of gets into the other next lessons that the Buddha, the teachings on karma teach you about goodwill. One of the questions is, why do you need it? And the first reason is to guarantee the skillfulness of your actions. If there are people that you cannot have goodwill for, it's going to be very easy to mistreat them. So when you're engaging with somebody, you've got to have goodwill for them, no matter how difficult they've been. Because what you're going to come away from the situation, regardless of how it comes out, is your, you know, the karma that you create by your actions. And so in order to guarantee for yourself, I'm going to be more likely to treat this person in a skillful way or act skillfully in this situation, I've got to have goodwill for everybody. That's the first reason. Remember that the question of having goodwill for the others is not whether they deserve your goodwill or not. It's not a question of deserving at all. It's a question of, okay, you need it. You need to develop this goodwill. And it's interesting that Buddha talks about goodwill as a restraint. It's basically, it puts restraint on your unskillful actions. Because we tend to think of goodwill as this big, open, you know, unfenced state of mind. But it's there to put restraint on your impulses that would pull you in the other direction. So it is a form of restraint. The other reason why you need it is the Buddha says it can actually mitigate the effects of your past bad karma by developing unlimited goodwill in the present moment. The image he gives is of a crystal of salt. He says, your past bad actions are like a crystal of salt. Your mind is like a body of water. Now, if your mind is like a little cup of water, you put the crystal of salt in the water, it becomes too salty to drink. That's a limited mind state. If you develop an unlimited mind state, it's like a large river of water, and assuming it's not polluted, you put the crystal of salt in there, and you can still drink the water, because there's just so much more water. In the same way your past bad actions come to you, if your mind is unlimited, it's going to have much less impact than if your mind is still, you know, holding grudges and holding resentments and plotting revenge. Now, it goes along with other abilities as well, like the ability not to be overcome by pain or overcome by pleasure, developing your virtue and your discernment. But having unlimited goodwill is an important aspect of not only creating good karma now, but also protecting you from your past bad actions. Just a minute, let me finish. We talked about earlier this morning that, you know, your experience of the present moment is not totally determined by your past actions. It's what you're doing now also determines how those past potentials are actually going to be actualized. Because sometimes you've probably heard this sometimes, people saying that, you know, if you want to see someone's future, you look at their present actions. You want to see their past, you look at their present condition, which is wrong. Because you cannot see everybody's past actions based on just what they are now. Because in other words, it's not like we have a single karma account and what you're seeing is the running balance. The Buddha's image is more like we have a whole field of seeds. Some of the seeds are sprouting now, other seeds are waiting to sprout. And some of the seeds will sprout faster because you water them right now. And other seeds will sprout more slowly because you're not watering them right now. There's a lot more give and take in the Buddha's explanation of causality than a simple deterministic, you know, your past is what shapes your present or your present is what shapes your future. Your present is being shaped not only by past potentials, but also how you actualize those potentials here and now. And then finally, one of the passages we have is, look at this in a minute, the karmic consequences of unlimited goodwill. You sleep easily, you wake up easily, you have no evil dreams. The devas love you, human beings love you. You're not going to be killed by fire, weapons, poison. And if you die with a clear conscience, and then if you don't have any higher attainments, you become a Brahma. All of which are good things. And then finally, what the other lesson you learn from applying the teaching of karma to goodwill is the question, how do you express goodwill in action? And it's not necessarily through being tender with people. In my own experience in the forest tradition is that I had never been so criticized in my life in such sharp terms as I was by my teacher. And it was because I trusted him that I was willing to put up with it and see, well, I was actually benefiting from the criticism. Sometimes I didn't even know how harsh the criticism was until I tried it on somebody else. I'll give you a brief story. There was a woman who came regularly to practice at the meditation at the monastery. She was the wife of one of the higher officials in the local roads bureau. And she had her own private roads bureau Land Rover, chauffeur driven, that she would come out. And she liked to park it right next to my hut. Now, this was after her husband had completed a road into the monastery complete with a parking lot. But she still liked to park it next to my hut. It was killing the grass. I didn't like this. So one day, I noticed, I was looking under the meditation hall, and I found a big railroad tie. And there was a spot where she had to go through a very narrow passage to get into the spot next to my hut. So I figured, this is it. So I put the railroad tie in the way. And the next day, they drove up. She got her chauffeur to get out, move the railroad tie, and park up. So I went back and I put the railroad tie back in place. And that evening, as she was leaving the monastery to go back home, you know, she got the chauffeur to move the railroad tie again, so they got out. So I put it back in place. She's got the message. Next day, she comes driving up, stops there. She's getting the chauffeur to get out, move the railroad tie again. And I have to be there. And I happen to use a phrase that a John Fuang had used with me many times, which was, don't you understand human language? And I didn't realize what an insult that was in Thailand. You know, it's like saying, well, you need to use dog language? She was livid. And she went up and she, you know, complained with John Fuang. She said, I understand deva language in my meditation. He's accusing me of not understanding human language. And, you know, it's like when your child says something, you know, child should not be saying, and you realize you know where that child got that. There was another woman who was watching all this, and she said, all John Fuang could do was laugh. Because he knew where I got that phrase. And so she went up and she tried to meditate, and she couldn't get into concentration, and she finally realized it was because she was angry at me. So she came down and apologized, and that was the end of the story. But at any rate, having goodwill for other people does not necessarily mean you always treat them with tenderness. Sometimes you have to treat them with harshness because it's a necessary way that's going to work. The Buddha himself said there are times when he would say things that are unpleasant because it was the right time and place. And the skill, of course, is learning the right time and place. You know, when you treat people with gentleness, when you have to treat them a little bit more harshness so that they actually protect themselves. So how do you really help other people? Is you get them to be virtuous. You try to induce them to follow the precepts. You try to induce them to overcome passion, aversion, and delusion. You're respecting the fact that they are agents, and not just recipients of your actions, but they are agents and they're going to be experiencing the results of their actions. So if you can get someone who's not observing the precepts to observe the precepts, that's how you show your goodwill. If there's someone who's easily overcome by passion, aversion, and delusion, if you can get them to pull back some, that's how you show goodwill. So those are some of the lessons that karma teaches you about what goodwill is and how to develop and why to develop it. Are there any questions? Yes.
Just on that last point, in terms of trying to help people or sharing, you know, the benefits of the Dharma and the practice with them. But I find like a lot of people are so resistant to any kind of new ideas or a different way of thinking in terms of one based in generosity versus based in selfishness. Mm-hmm. And that there's only so much that you can engage with these people before just even engaging with them on a superficial level will cause you harm, mm-hmm. In terms of what they take from you. Mm-hmm. So what's the kind of balance there in terms of the degree to which you engage with these people? And
well, again, if you find that it's your efforts to help them are not working, you might say, I've got to pull back for a bit. This is where you have to develop equanimity, realizing there's some people you can reach and other people can't reach. Because they have to choose to listen. They have to choose to follow through. You can't make other people's decisions for them. But you try. And there's that great piece recently that Steve showed me last night. It was on The Daily Show, where they're talking about, you know, how you know, if you were being ethnically cleansed by Buddhists, they're probably the worst people to be ethnically cleansed by. But he's saying, well, you're, we're not depriving you of anything that really was yours to begin with. You know? Which would be really, you know, infuriating. So you don't want to come with the sort of Buddhist holier-than-thou attitude. But you have to look at, okay, where are these people? What would be the kind of lesson that they actually might listen to? If they're being selfish, you say, well, hey, you know, maybe you could advance your own, what you think is your own interest by being showing a little bit more kindness to other people. And I know in the case of my father, if I was going to give my father some Buddhist advice, I would never use the B word. You know. Just kind of, okay, this is basically common sense. So again, you don't come with this, you know, this is what Buddhism had to say, but you know, just basic common sense. And if you can present it that way, that makes it easier for some people to take. But there are a lot of people out there you can't reach.
And I mean, just to follow up on that, I mean, if you kind of give them the opportunity and then they decline it, is it okay to just kind of move on from that relationship and leave it behind?
That's up to you. It really depends on how you read the situation.
My question was going to be about goodwill for people who you know are harming you mm-hmm. right now, and the image of the people who are sawing your limbs and holding goodwill. Somehow I have a feeling that a non-ill will, or rather, is probably a little better in...
What is better?
I was thinking that probably non-ill will mm-hmm. would be a better image of what a person, what at least I could hold in my mind if I were in such a situation, mm-hmm. rather than a sense of positive goodwill, like, okay, mm-hmm. may they be happy. I'd rather
as they continue to saw my limbs.
Yeah, I'd rather have it as, may they stop doing this mm-hmm. so that it doesn't lead to their long-term harm.
That's goodwill.
But more than that, may they just stop doing this so it stops harming me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whether or not I care so much about their long-term happiness. Okay.
It's useful to take some of the sting away from the fact that I'm being hurt right now.
Uh-huh.
And just say, okay, I can accept the fact that this person is harming me right now. But if I focus on the fact that I'm being harmed by that person right now, I want it to stop. Then it's very hard to get my mind above that.
Hmm. Okay.
I'm trying to think of something went through my mind just now, and then as I looked at you, I forgot.
Sorry for that face.
What was it? I'll come back to that. Yeah. Oh, the Buddha's example when he was sick. Devadatta rolls the rock down on him, and the stone sliver pierces his foot, and so he's lying down. And Mara comes up to taunt him. So what are you, sleepyhead, you know, just moping around because you've been, well, and the Buddha says, no, I'm lying down out of sympathy for all beings. And one, okay, the fact that I have to look after myself so I can continue to teach. But two, instead of focusing on the fact that I've been hurt by this other person, I'm going to have goodwill for everybody. That takes you away from, you know, the fact that I am a suffering being right now. Why am I sick? Why is this happening to me? Say, may all beings be happy. That pulls you out of that particular inner conversation.
So I've spent years spending at least 2 hours on the freeways every day, getting back and forth, which is a lot of time to experience ill will and.
Yeah.
And so what works of late, more and more works for me, is as soon as I start like leaning on the horn or something like that, it hurts me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I start to realize that, geez, you know, and then I end up carrying it. And then the way I finally think about it is to let the ill will stop here. Mm-hmm. And not keep circulating it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of works for me. Like if somebody cuts me off, and oh, you know, they shouldn't have done that and everything. That, mm-hmm. If I just kind of sponge it up, you know, not be, you know, protect myself and all, but mm-hmm. it's like it doesn't keep recirculating and I don't come away kind of polluted by it.
Yeah. Well, again, there's somebody up there thinking, who is that idiot leaning on his horn? And so you say, well, I don't want to give them more fuel for passing this on. And it's with any kind of bad karma. You think, well, may it stop right there.
Yeah.
And don't think of it that you have to sponge it up. It stopped right there in front of you.
Okay.
It's your choice as to whether you're going to pick it up or not. And John Lee has a great image. I mean, it's like other people say really nasty things to you. Mm-hmm. It's like they spit out something and you go down and you pick it up and eat it. Now, who are you going to blame, you know, for the fact that you get sick? Say, okay, there are idiots on the highway. This is part of the human condition. And don't say, well, geez, this is really outrageous. How could they do that? Well, they're doing it every day.
You know? That makes sense, the idea that I'm hurting myself, actually.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Realizing that they're not hurting me. Mm-hmm.
I thought we have more discussion on this topic. Let's look at the passages then. The basis of goodwill is this passage number 9. Is everybody trembles at the rod, or all are fearful of death. And it's drawing the parallel to yourself, neither kill nor get others to kill. In other words, you're basically taking your own fear of death, all your own fear of punishment, realize everybody else has that same fear. And then the follow-up is, okay, don't harm anybody. Not only that, but don't get other people to harm. Because that way you're doing a double layer of harm. It's interesting that in the monks' rules, there is no rule against suicide, but there is a rule against committing suicide in a way that harms somebody else. An even stronger rule against getting somebody to kill you. Because you're doing double harm to the person who kills you. Okay. Next two passages are, you know, you'd hear about metta phrases. Well, these are the Buddha's metta phrases. Think, happy at rest, may all beings be happy at heart. Whatever beings there may be, weak or strong without exception, long, large, middling, short, subtle, blatant, seen and unseen, near and far, born and seeking birth. Seeking birth, that's a simple way to see that's a character of, it's a class of beings that haven't found the place where they're going to settle down yet. It's kind of an intermediate stage where they're still looking around. And I've got some great stories about these if you're interested. May all beings be happy at heart. And then the Buddha goes on, not only may they be happy, but not only that, may they not do unskillful things, which is what the following passage is. Let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere or through anger or resistance wish for another to suffer. So not only are you saying, I want you to be happy, but also I don't want you to create the causes for your own suffering by despising other people or mistreating other people. So again, you're treating everybody as agents, not simply as recipients of your actions. So it means you're not going to try to get somebody else. You don't kill, but you get somebody else to kill for you. You don't steal, but you get somebody else to steal for you, that kind of thing. And then, as a mother would risk her child to protect her only child, even though so, one should cultivate the heart limitlessly with regard to all beings. That's the passage where the Buddha is basically saying, you protect your goodwill in the same way that a mother would protect her child. The sutta goes on to say, one should resolve on this mindfulness. This is where I was talking about how it's, you know, you have to be mindful to do this because this is not an innate quality of the mind. Or in other words, it's not more innate than ill will. You have potentials for both in the mind, so you have to cultivate this. Make up your mind, you're going to be determined, I'm going to treat this person or wish this person well. And you turn them that, and then you've got to keep that in mind. Passage 11, this is another metta passage. May these beings, free from animosity, free from oppression, and free from trouble, look after themselves with ease. In other words, you're not saying, I hope that I will be there for them all the time. I'm hoping they will be there for themselves. Because that's, nobody wants to be dependent on someone else for their happiness. Everyone wants to have their own ability to maintain their own happiness. So you're wishing that for them. Yes. Where's the mic?
Can we talk a little bit about goodwill to ourselves mm-hmm. and what form that should take? And let's say a pure form of that would be, may I act skillfully. Mm-hmm. What do we do when we make a mistake and we don't act skillfully?
Okay, what's the kindest thing to do to deal with a mistake? On the one hand is to admit the mistake, and secondly is to resolve you're not going to repeat it. And it's that point the Buddha says, again, then you also extend goodwill to yourself and other beings. Goodwill to yourself, so that you're not constantly coming down on yourself for having made the mistake. Remind yourself that it's part of the human condition that we're going to make mistakes. And then goodwill for others, because that helps confirm your motivation for not wanting to harm others.
A follow-up to that question, suppose you know you've made a mistake mm-hmm. and you want to remember that you made that mistake so you don't repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you remember you've made that mistake and you tell yourself, I made this mistake, how do you remember it and still not get down on yourself or come down upon yourself? Because I do have things to remind myself. I did this. This was wrong. This was not what I should have done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I use that as a way to kind of maybe kill my sensual desires or whatever it is. And but there's no way I'm able to see this as not coming down on myself. I feel like it's okay to do that. Or maybe I'm wrong.
To an extent. I mean, you have to make sure, as the Buddha said, there are times when you have to be harsh with other people out of goodwill. So there are times when you have to be harsh with yourself out of goodwill. Mm. Especially if you see yourself coming back and making the mistake over and over and over again. And you have to sort of up the strength of your tendency inside. But also, when you don't make the mistake, and the next day you feel better, oh, I'm really glad I didn't do that again, remember that. And that becomes part of your motivation. You go, okay, remember the last time I was tempted to do this, but I felt better when I didn't do it in the long run? Don't I care for myself? So make sure that underlying the harshness is the consciousness, okay, I'm doing this for my own good. And that I really will be happier when I don't do this. Question back there.
Okay, so I have a question that relates to goodwill and discernment. I've been thinking about that a lot lately, in kind of thinking that the link between the two, like I feel that I feel like goodwill supports discernment.
Mm-hmm. And discernment supports goodwill.
And discernment supports goodwill.
They help each other along.
Yeah. Can you talk a little more about how goodwill supports discernment? Like, the example that comes to my mind is if you see someone else suffering, mm-hmm. and you have goodwill for that person, you will be more able to discern what they may need that you could do to help. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little more of how goodwill helps good discernment?
Goodwill helps. Well, you know, the Buddha's teaching the Four Noble Truths. He's concerned about putting an end to suffering. And that's, he says, this is the best use of your discernment. And this is where the teachings and the suttas really emphasize that, okay, the whole underlying motivation or the best use of your discernment is to put an end to suffering. And that, what is that motivated by? It's motivated by goodwill. May beings be happy. Compassion comes out of goodwill. Yeah. Because basically you've got compassion, goodwill, compassion, empathetic joy. And goodwill is the umbrella. And then compassion is when you see somebody suffering, goodwill basically wishes for that suffering to stop. If you see somebody who's happy, goodwill is happy for their happiness and wishes it to continue. So goodwill is what covers the whole.
I guess when I see the Eightfold Path, like I would be thinking, or I interpreted it when I was doing the program as I'm doing the path for myself. Mm-hmm. But the question what I was asking was, you know,
goodwill for others?
Goodwill supports discernment towards others. Mm-hmm. You know, so I can see that goodwill supports discernment towards myself, right? Mm-hmm. If I hate myself, I won't be able to see things to improve or something. But the question that interests me is how goodwill towards someone else will help you have more discernment towards them. That makes sense?
Well, with dealing with other people, it's the same sort of thing. Our motivation for practicing is not only to lessen our own suffering, but if you get more competent in handling your suffering, you're going to be less of a burden on others. And you see this most vividly if you know someone who's never really practiced and they're on their deathbed and they're just miserable. And they reach the point where you really can't get through to them. And you know, the suffering that the people there watching this person suffering, because they can't handle their own suffering. I mean, if you actually are able to control, deal with the problem of your own suffering so that you're not going to be burden on other people, that's actually a gift to them.
Yes, but I was trying to ask about the different is I feel it's not just my not being a burden on others, but it's actually my bringing good things into the world by being more discerning of the needs of others because I have goodwill for them. If I had ill will for someone, I wouldn't have as much discernment of their needs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little more about that?
Well, this is the basic principle of karma. Is that if you actually want for your own happiness, part of your being happiness is learning how not to harm other people. As you get more and more sensitive, well, what in what ways am I actually harming other people through my actions? And I'll learn how to stop doing that, because otherwise it's going to rebound back on me. So it gives you your motivation for being kind to others. That's what the discernment teaches, your goodwill. And why you should treat other people as you would like to be treated yourself. Or avoid doing things that you would not like to have done to you. And also, if you're suffering less, you're going to see their needs more clearly, more objectively. Because if you're going through life trying to feed off of other people, you're seeing other people as food. And you're not going to see them, well, how are they suffering in the process of my feeding off of them? It's like the hunters who say, you know, the rabbit gave itself to me. It's because they want to eat it. If they didn't want to eat the rabbit, then they would realize, oh my gosh, I'm just shooting this poor rabbit. So if you're able to take care of your own inner needs, then you see somebody else. It's not so much, how can I feed off of this person? The question is, what can I offer this person now? So that even your help, there are cases when your help to somebody else is actually your way of feeding off of that person. Gotta watch out for that. Question over here.
Just for my own understanding, could I emphasize these Brahma Viharas and goodwill as a way, as a refuge, using those skills as a refuge towards unskillful acts and own well-being? Mm-hmm. Is that a way of summarizing?
Well, again, it's protection for you. Yeah. The Buddha talks about having goodwill for others as a protection for yourself. And as you're doing the practice, that's also protecting others. The image he gives is the acrobats. One acrobat is standing on the other one. Each one has to look after his own or her own balance so as not to throw the other person off of balance. That's the way in which, looking after yourself, you're going to be looking after others. He says the opposite principle also works. There are times when going out of your way for others, being more compassionate to them, having more endurance as they abuse you, is developing your own inner strengths. So the two go together. The whole issue about, are you going to be helping others, or are you going to be helping yourself in the practice? And for the Theravada, there's no clear line. As you're helping yourself, you're helping others, you're helping others, you're helping yourself. Okay. Next topic. Oh, go ahead, Jeff. Here's Michael.
So then how do you discern when your helping others is not actually helping them, even though you think that it is, or it appears that it may be?
This is where you have to really look carefully.
So what questions would you ask yourself even to broach that? Because we become so embedded in, I'm helping this person, I must be helping myself, it's a good thing. What would be an indicator that there might be something underneath that, very subtle? What would be some flags to say, maybe not?
To know when you're overextending yourself, you have to ask yourself, how's my meditation going? Is my meditation getting worse as I'm helping more and more and more and more people? That's the first thing you would look at. And then if they begin to show signs that they don't like your help, maybe that's a sign that it's not really helping them. Because sometimes they're showing signs all over the place and you're ignoring them.
Are you getting resentful?
Yeah, are you getting resentful for the help you have to give? And then you have to ask yourself, is this my parent? I have to learn how to put up with resentment to teach myself not to resent.
But then you also have to still be willing to give attention to the person.
Again, if the student doesn't like to help, there comes a point where their resistance is so great you realize you're not helping them. I mean, you have to say things that they're not going to like, but then you have to see, okay, what is this person's reaction? Which is one of the reasons why, you know, as a teacher, I have to say some outrageous things to my students, just to see, are they willing to put up with criticism? It's good to see how they react to criticism. It's like when you're dating. You're dating someone, what is this person like when he or she is angry? So you say something to make them angry. You never did that? I mean, obviously, look at me, I'm a monk. I mean, I've never done that, but... But I always wanted to know, you know, what is this woman going to be like if she, you know, if I can make her angry, really make her angry without meaning to? What's her anger like? In some cases, I didn't have to do anything. There was one particular one woman I was dating, and I saw her tear into her father one time. That scared me. I said, whoa, if she can do that to her father, imagine what she can do to me. That was the beginning of the end, okay. But as a student, as a teacher, you have to be able to test your students. Okay, if I criticize a student, you know, how are they going to take it? But as for resentment, I mean, there are times when you're helping your parents and they're really, really hard and you have to say, wait a minute. When I was a kid, they cleaned up my shit. They put up with all the crying in the middle of the night. And at least, you know, I owe them a debt. So that's when you have to talk yourself into, don't resent this. You've got to remember you have a debt of gratitude. The other people you don't quite have that debt of gratitude. So, well, maybe I'm, you know, doing this much for this person. They don't seem to appreciate it. They don't seem to, you know, be benefiting from it. There must be other places I can give my help that would be more fruitful. Yes, in the back.
Just in terms of building goodwill as a refuge, is there a particular kind of strategy in terms of, you know, say you start with goodwill for, you know, a teacher that you've learned from and then a family member that's cared for you or an animal or a pet or something, and then you work your way up to kind of the people who have harmed you? Mm-hmm. I mean, starting from, you know, a point of stillness and then working, or do you just go straight to the person who's harmed you and then just do your best to kind of wish goodwill for them?
Well, sometimes, I mean, if you have the leisure to be doing this, you know, not in the heat of the moment, it's better to start out with someone that you find it easy for. But then you also have to remind yourself, well, what does it mean to have goodwill for somebody? This doesn't mean I have to say, you know, may you continue, you know, sending out drones and be happy. You may say, well, maybe someday you may see it's a bad thing to be sending out drones. Because there are other times when, you know, someone, you know, in the thick of the battle or the thick of traffic or whatever, someone, you know, does something really outrageous. You guys go, okay, goodwill for this person, regardless of how easier. But remind yourself, it doesn't mean I have to like what they're doing. I don't even have to like the person. Just remind yourself, I don't want to act in a way that's going to harm that person. So I've got to think about their happiness. Goodwill is fueling yourself so you don't eat the sugar of revenge. So as a beginning exercise, you want to work your way up gradually. But then you want to be able to go right to whoever you're dealing with, regardless of how much you like them or dislike them.
Is it okay to kind of think, in the same way of the foulness of the body or the aversion aspect, to think how they're suffering and to use that as a way to develop compassion towards them?
That's one way of doing it. In fact, the Buddha in that passage where he talks about being able to think about the good points of other people as a way of fueling your goodwill for these other people, he says sometimes you will run into people you can't see anything good about them at all. He says in that case you have to have compassion. This person is creating a lot of bad karma for him or herself. And so it's not up to me to pile on. sort of to make things even worse. Again, that's this is a kind of restraint. This holds you back from wanting to do harm to that person. So as with the contemplation of the body, you start out with bodies that are easy to contemplate and say, oh yeah, that really is ugly. And then you work up to ones that are, you know, you find more and more attractive. But then when it actually comes, you're confronted with someone who's really attractive, but you know, if you got involved with that person, it would really be bad. That's when you've got to, you know, right then and there, be able to think about that. To pull up that perception. So when you're dealing with someone who's really difficult, you have to be able to pull up the perception, okay, I've got to have goodwill for this person. And then remind yourself, well, how did I create the ill will? Through the way I was breathing, the way I'm talking to myself, I've got to change the way I breathe, change the way I talk to myself about this situation. Okay, should we break there for a few minutes? Okay. Come back in about 15 minutes.